variant. Experiments suggested that some of the mutations might make the variants better able to infect cells. Other mutations let them evade antibodies from previous infections or produced by vaccines. As Dr. Faria and his colleagues analyzed their results, researchers in Japan were making a similar discovery. Four tourists returning home from a trip to the Amazon on 4th of January tested positive for the coronavirus. Genome sequencing revealed the same set of mutations Dr. Faria and his colleagues were seeing in Brazil. Dr. Faria and his colleagues posted a description of P1 on an online virology forum on 12th of January. They then investigated why P1 was so common. Its mutations may have made it more contagious, or it might have been lucky. By sheer chance, the variant might have shown up in Manaus, just as the city was getting more relaxed about public health measures. It was also possible that P1 became common because it could reinfect people. Normally, coronavirus reinfections are rare because the antibodies produced by the body after infection are potent for months. But it was possible that P1 carried mutations that made it harder for those antibodies to latch onto it, allowing it to slip into human cells and cause new infections. The researchers tested these possibilities by tracking P1 from its earliest samples in December. By early January, it made up 87% of samples. By February, it had taken over completely. Combining the data from genomes, antibodies, and medical records in Manaus, the researchers concluded that P1 conquered the city thanks not to luck, but to biology. Its mutations helped it spread. Like the B117 variant, it can infect more people on average than other variants can. They estimate it is somewhere between 1.4 and 2.2 times more transmissible than other lineages of the coronavirus. But it also gets an edge from mutations that let it escape antibodies from other coronaviruses. They estimate that in 100 people who were infected in Manaus last year, somewhere between 25 and 61 of them may have been reinfected by the P1 variant. The researchers found support for this conclusion in an experiment in which they mixed P1 viruses with antibodies from Brazilians who had COVID-19 last year. They found that the effectiveness of their antibodies dropped sixfold against P1 compared with other coronaviruses. That drop might mean that at least some people would be vulnerable to new infections from P1. There seems to be an increasing body of evidence that suggests that most of the cases associated with the second wave are indeed sort of reinfections, Dr. Faria said. Dr. Faria and other researchers are now looking across Brazil to observe P1 spread. Dr. Esther Sabino, an infectious disease expert at the University of Sao Paulo School of Medicine, said that one of the new outbreaks arose in Araraquara, a Brazilian city of 223,000 people, which did not have high rates of COVID-19 before P1's arrival. If people in Araraquara did not have high levels of antibodies before P1's arrival, she said, that suggests that the variant may be able to spread in places without Manaus' extreme history. This might happen in any other place, she said. Michael Worobe, a virologist at the University of Arizona in the United States, who was not involved in the research, said it was time to pay attention to P1 in the United States. Worobe expected it would become more common in the United States, although it would have to compete with the B117 variant, which may soon become the predominant variant in much of the nation. At the very least, it's going to be one of the contenders, Dr. Worobe said. In their experiments, Dr. Faria and his colleagues also tested antibodies from 8 people who received Coronavac, a Chinese-made vaccine that has been used in Brazil. They found that the vaccine-generated antibodies were less effective at stopping the P1 variant than other types. Dr. Faria cautioned that these results derived from cells in test tubes don't necessarily mean that vaccines will be less effective at protecting real people from the P1 variant. Vaccines may very well provide strong protection from P1 even if the antibodies they generate aren't quite as potent. And even if the variant manages to infect vaccinated people, they will likely remain shielded from a severe bout of COVID-19. For Dr. Sabino, the ultimate importance of P1 variant is the threat that concerning variants pose, that they can pop up anywhere in the world. It's just a matter of time and chance, she said.
The world will never forget the gruesome assassination of dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The outspoken critic of the Saudi regime was killed and dismembered inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in October 2018. Shortly after the killing, the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency assessed with high confidence that Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, had personally ordered the assassination. The case turned into a severe political storm, triggering global condemnation of the Saudis. However, then U.S. President Donald Trump chose to stand with the notorious Crown Prince and rejected calls to condemn him. Trump's White House dismissed intelligence that bin Salman personally ordered the killing. The former American president made no secret of what was behind his unrelenting support for bin Salman. Trump stressed that he did not want to sacrifice billions of dollars in U.S. arms sales to Saudi Arabia over the matter. The previous U.S. administration blocked the release of the intelligence community's findings into the killing. Trump's successor, Joe Biden, is apparently taking a different course. Biden said during a presidential campaign rally that Khashoggi was murdered and that he believes the Crown Prince ordered the hit. His administration is now releasing a declassified version of a top-secret intelligence report that singles out the Saudi Crown Prince for at least giving the go-ahead for the assassination, if not directly ordering it. Biden has pledged to take a tough line on Saudi Arabia's human rights violations and its war on Yemen.
Biden, I think, is signaling MBS and the world that the United States is getting back on board as a leader in diplomacy, as a world leader. And you're not going to be those things if you're led around the world by the nose by a Saudi feudal prince. That's got to change. Didn't change under Trump. Didn't change under Obama. I hope to see Biden change that.
The new U.S. administration has made some policy changes regarding Saudi Arabia. U.S. President Joe Biden has ended American support for offensive operations in the Saudi-led war in Yemen and has freezed the sales of weapons to the kingdom. These are not looking very bright for the relationship between the two allies, at least for now. The release of the report on the assassination of Khashoggi is expected to further strain the ties between the two sides. However, during a call with the Saudi king on Thursday, Biden told Salman that he would work for bilateral ties as strongly and transparently as possible. Biden and top administration officials have stressed that they are committed to Saudi Arabia's security. Biden has been in office for a little more than a month, and it is definitely too soon to judge his decisions. The Saudi kingdom is right now a major foreign policy dilemma for the White House. Even if Biden is willing to punish the Saudis for their rights violations and destabilizing actions like their war in Yemen, the road ahead for him will be very bumpy. This is because the kingdom is a long-standing U.S. ally with many powerful friends in Washington. Meanwhile, Saudi petrodollars will definitely not be easy for the Americans to resist.
On September 11, 2001, two hijacked airplanes were flown into the twin World Trade Center buildings, killing almost 3,000 people. Soon after, then-President George W. Bush announced that time has come for the world to come together and fight a war against all those who seek to export terror. That announcement gave birth to the first war of the 21st century, the so-called War on Terror. 20 years after the invasion of Afghanistan by the U.S.-led forces, the U.S. counterterrorism operations have only expanded. A recent report published by the Costs of War Project at Brown University's Watson Institute and USA Today shows that despite the talk of refocusing on great power competition, counterterrorism policy of Washington has not changed. According to the report, the U.S. military has been in over 85 countries in the past 3 years. U.S. troops have conducted bombing or ground attacks in 10 countries, including Afghanistan, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Kenya, Libya, Mali, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Somalia over the same period. Washington also owns nearly 800 offshore military bases on all six continents. That's while China, as the biggest competitor of the U.S., has only one official overseas military base in Djibouti. Another report by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, revealed that the U.S. spent over $732 billion on national defense in 2019. That was more than the next 10 countries combined. The forever war has lasted for two decades, to the tune of $6.4 trillion, resulting in calls on Washington to reassess its policies as there are doubts whether the benefits to U.S. security outweigh the costs. The ongoing war has taken a heavy toll, as over 15,000 U.S. troops and contractors, nearly 12,500 allied troops, 177,000 national military and police officers, 1,300 journalists and humanitarian aid workers, and nearly 336,000 civilians have lost their lives, while only 260,000 enemy fighters have been killed. Some estimates put the total number of people killed as a result of the war on terror at around 2 million.
The U.S. has nothing positive to show for this two decades of terror and violence around the globe. What it does have to show for it is increased hostility toward the United States everywhere, which of course justifies, in the minds of U.S. government officials, the purchase of more military equipment and more interference.
Back in 2019, during a foreign policy speech, Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden urged the ending of forever wars, saying that it has cost dearly for the U.S. However, Biden is linked to people who have strong ties to the military industry that is driving this war. Over 8 out of 23 picks for the Department of Defense Agency Review team by Biden were linked to organizations, think tanks, or companies which were directly funded by the weapons industry or were part of it. Interestingly, 3 of those 8 were employed in the Center for Strategic and International Studies, which receives funding from Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon Technologies, and General Dynamics, as well as other weapons manufacturers and oil companies. Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon Technologies, and General Dynamics account for over 50% of the industry's lobbying. Defense companies spend millions every year lobbying politicians and donating their campaigns. That will ease the way for them to sell their missiles and guns and other equipment to countries around the world. Just 200 defense companies reported lobbying the federal government in the year 2020.
We definitely are. These are people who think war is the way of resolving any perceived problem that the United States has with any other nation. Diplomacy is not something that they have any respect or regard for whatsoever. This is proven in the various ways they have dealt with the situation throughout their careers.
The post-9/11 wars seem to be endless, and the latest figures and statistics approve that notion. Despite President Joe Biden's claims of ending the war, it seems the gulf between his words and reality is too wide. While defense contractors lobby for selling their arms and weapon industry lobbyists become Joe Biden advisors, isn't Biden administration then a war administration?
On Thursday, the United States carried out airstrikes against facilities belonging to anti-terror resistance groups on the Iraqi-Syrian border. White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki said the raid authorized by Biden had been, quote, deliberate and meant to de-escalate the overall situation in both eastern Syria and Iraq. The military action was said to be in retaliation for recent attacks against American bases and missions in Iraq, which Washington has blamed on so-called Iran-backed Iraqi resistance groups. In the latest such attacks, rockets hit Baghdad's Green Zone, which houses the U.S. Embassy and other missions, on Monday. The American military base at the Erbil International Airport had similarly been attacked days earlier. The Iraqi resistance groups and many Iraqi officials have, however, roundly dismissed Washington's allegations, blaming rogue elements. Pro-Western media outlets describe the U.S. air raid on the Iraq-Syria border as a signal to Iran, which they claim is using Iraq's PMU as a, quote, proxy force in the neighboring country, allegations that Tehran has categorically denied.
Joe Biden is a neocon. He has surrounded himself in his foreign policy, his national security advisor, secretary of state, ambassador to the United Nations, the Pentagon, has surrounded himself with the same cast of characters to a very large degree who took care of foreign policy during both the Clinton administration and the Obama administration. This is a very aggressive group.
Damascus has slammed the U.S. air raid as a cowardly act of aggression, describing it as a bad sign from the administration of the new president, Joe Biden. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Saeed Khatibzadeh, also condemned the U.S. attack as a continuation of raids carried out by Israel on Syria in violation of international law. U.S. President Joe Biden's order to attack the Iraqi anti-terrorism groups on the border with Syria has been criticized both at home and abroad. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said on Friday that the United States had notified Moscow of the impending attack on the PMU facility 4 or 5 minutes ahead of time. The Russian Foreign Minister said the U.S. military is present on the Syrian soil illegally in violation of all norms of international law, including Security Council resolutions on the reconciliation in the Syrian Arab Republic. He said Russia had received unconfirmed information that the U.S. is planning to stay in Syria indefinitely. Meanwhile, the Chinese Foreign Ministry also reacted to the U.S. air raid, warning against any action that further complicates the situation in the crisis-hit Syria. Also, a number of Democratic U.S. lawmakers have found fault with the legal justifications of President Joe Biden's administration for the airstrikes, demanding that the officials at the White House immediately brief Congress on the matter. Many expected the Biden era to mark a departure from the damaging and warmongering approach of the Trump administration. It now appears that Biden is following the footsteps of the former president.
Really, Joe Biden has a career as a neocon. He supported the Iraq war and the invasion and occupation of Iraq when he was in the Senate, and in a very influential position as the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. As the vice president, he was personally tasked with dealing with the coup in Ukraine and the overthrow of the government, the constitution of a new government that would meet the needs or demands of Washington. And we could go on and on. I mean, going back to wars in Central America in the 1980s, Trump, when some of the liberals who follow and support Biden said when Trump fired the missiles, ordered the missiles fired into Syria early in his presidency, they declared that's what made him presidential. So I guess, you know, we have to take it that making war is what makes a U.S. president a real president.
Biden authorized the attack in another sovereign state in his second month in office. Does he really have a change in the U.S. foreign policy in mind? Or are there more conflicts to come? On Friday, Amnesty International published a report expressing concern over escalating violence in the northern Ethiopia. The report said Eritrean troops fighting Tigray People's Operation Front (TPLF) rebels have killed hundreds of civilians in the city of Aksum, located in neighboring Ethiopia, in a 24-hour operation carried out in late November. The operation was said to be in response to a TPLF attack on a temporary mountainside Eritrean base. The rights group said satellite image analysis has backed up reports of indiscriminate shelling and mass looting. It also found signs of new mass graves near two of the city's churches. This is while Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, who won the 2019 Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts to break the 20-year post-war deadlock with Eritrea, said not a single civilian was killed during the November operation when pro-government forces captured the regional capital, Mekelle. Also, both Ethiopia and Eritrea have denied the presence of Eritrean troops in the Tigray region.
And they also claim, these two governments, that no killings took place. That's where we are right now. And it's still ongoing, because conflict now between the report by Amnesty International and also the governments continuing to claim. Since the conflict, we have problems in this area of Tigray.
The Amnesty report was followed by a U.S. government document that said Ethiopia is conducting a systematic campaign of ethnic cleansing in the north of the country. The internal report obtained by the New York Times said tens of thousands of people are unaccounted for after Ethiopian officials and militia forced people out of their villages and houses. It added that Ethiopia is committing an act of ethnic cleansing by forcing people to flee, rounding them up, and relocating them to other parts of Tigray. Due to communications blackout and restricted access to the region for journalists, little is known about the humanitarian situation in the region.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Hello, welcome to the light. Sophisticated scanning technology is revealing new secrets about Littlefoot. That's a well-preserved fossil of an early human forerunner dating back to nearly 3.7 million years ago.
Now, the importance of it is not only that it is the only complete skull of an Australopithecus from anywhere, but it is the only one with a complete skeleton as well. Furthermore, it is the oldest Australopithecus in southern Africa, dating to 3.67 million years ago. So it tells us a lot about our early ancestry. Now, we're not saying that Littlefoot represents a direct ancestor to modern humans, but certainly a relative, certainly a very close relative of our ancestors.
The fossil was found in South Africa in the 1990s. It's now being studied at a particle accelerator facility in Oxfordshire, Britain. The facility allows scientists to produce X-ray images of the fossil with extreme detail. They say the result has been fascinating.
The bone microstructure look amazing because we can really see the different tissues, the proportions, the thickness, and also the size of the different canals. So all of this make Littlefoot more like a living person.
So far, scientists have found that Littlefoot stood on her feet. They know she had gorilla-like features such as powerful hands, which enabled her to climb trees. But she also had different traits compared to the human species believed to have first appeared 300,000 years ago. A Nigerian artist has become famous for his skills in creating art from coconut shells. Nathaniel Hodonu uses the shells to make stunning artworks in different forms, including portraits and sculptures, as well as home accessories. He collects shells from local oil factories, which throw them away as waste. He began his work in 2006 after his art teacher gave him two coconuts as a present. Hodonu now teaches art lovers creative ways to transform waste coconut shells into beautiful handicraft.
Tourism in Oman took a nosedive during the COVID-19 pandemic, sadly, much like many places in the world. But one village managed to turn its fortunes around by transforming some ancient homes into hotels and touristic attractions. Nestled in the high mountains of Oman, the village of Misfat al-Ibrahim offers some of the most beautiful and serene natural areas for trail running and rock climbing. Now the village has repurposed ancient mud brick homes into boutique hotels. The beige-coloured homes with walls of handmade mud brick are elegant and simple. And the interior spaces are furnished with traditional wood and textiles.
Misfat al-Ibrahim attracts many tourists, so people and project owners in the village have planned on expanding touristic projects. You'll find heritage hotels, popular cafes and restaurants. We, as a company, decided to provide various adventure-related activities too.
The centuries-old homes were renovated for safety and comfort to combine old Omani life with modern amenities. The village is near what is called Oman's Grand Canyon and has somewhere around 800 residents. Many tourists have visited the area because of the heritage hotels and environmental components in the ancient village. These inns have attracted many tourists to the area despite the COVID-19 pandemic. Almost everyone has seen snowmen, but how many people have encountered a snow snake in their lifetime? A family in the US has awed their neighborhood with a fascinating ice sculpture of a serpent. The household in Colorado spent 10 hours making the impressive artwork in their front yard. They first created the shape of the animal and then sprayed paint on it to bring it to life. The sculpture measures 23 meters in length. It has attracted many neighbors and passers-by who occasionally take pictures with it. This is not the first time the family made headlines with their ice work. In 2019, they caught people's eyes with an ice sculpture of a tiger. A giant ice disc with an even greater message here. People in Finland have carved a humongous carousel in Lake Lapajärvi to raise awareness about global warming. An inventor and a team of helpers spent days in sub-zero temperatures to create what they say is the world's largest ice carousel. The rotating machine is over 300 meters wide and is spun by motorboats. The makers also carved another smaller disc in the ice next to it. The two carousels were commissioned by local authorities who want to bring attention to climate change and shortening winters in Finland. An iceberg the size of Greater London breaks off in Antarctica years after the first cracks appeared. The iceberg detached from the Brunt Ice Shelf near a British research station and is expected to either move away or run aground not far from the ice shelf. Scientists were expecting the calving of the iceberg to happen after monitoring the area with GPS instruments and satellite imagery on a daily basis. They discovered the first cracks almost 10 years ago, but they are skeptical about the role of climate change in this case.
A unique remnant of bygone days. Archaeologists have found a rare ancient Roman ceremonial carriage outside Pompeii. The carriage was unearthed near the stables of a village just outside the very city. It has four wheels and is made of iron, bronze, and tin. The vehicle is the first of its kind discovered in the area. Italy's culture minister has called it a unique find without any precedent in the country. Pompeii was buried under ash and a volcanic eruption in 79 AD. So far, about two-thirds of the ancient city has been uncovered, I should say. The lights, merriment, and traditional food. That's what China's Lantern Festival has brought to millions of people across the country.
Loneliness can hit anyone at any time, but it becomes severe during the pandemic-like scenario the world is going through. But some Japanese are enjoying the companionship of robots to overcome loneliness as they are unable to meet their loved ones during the coronavirus. The cute singing snowman is called Charlie. He is one among a large number of new generation clever robots being produced in Japan. Manufacturers are making a wide variety of affordable androids as well as robotic pets, and they say their sales are booming. They also say their products have found favor with customers of all ages, not just kids. Studies have shown that therapeutic pets can bring comfort to dementia patients.
Spring is coming and blossoming flowers are once again creating stunning sceneries across China. clouds of cherry blossoms have created breathtaking views in Wuhan, a city known for being the birthplace of COVID-19. Inside the city, the main university is one of the best places to enjoy those blossoms, being well known for that among the Chinese. Students are thrilled to enjoy the floral scenery after missing it last year.
As the pandemic has been well brought under control in China so far this year, residents in Wuhan City, as well as students, workers and teachers of the university all come for the flowers and the warm spring.
In other cities, it is the plum flower that attracts a large number of visitors. They say the white-colored blossoms on mountains seem as if it had been snowing. Many of the tourists choose to stay in resorts that offer picturesque views of flowers. Many say they wait for a year so that they can draw a picture of the blossoms.
Police across the globe are using new methods to prevent crime and improve their performance. Now, Pakistani police have come up with an idea to put officers on rollerblades to catch criminals in the commercial hub Karachi. The new armed rollerblading unit is going through rigorous training for over a month with the aim of curbing theft and harassment on the streets. During the training, they were seen carefully balancing on skates while leaping over staircases or lifting their guns. The unit, made up of 10 men and 10 women, would be sent to public places. The chief of the unit says rollerblades make chasing thieves on motorcycles through the city of 20 million much easier.
We felt we needed to come up with some innovative approach to control street crime in Karachi. We analyzed and saw that there are certain spots where crime incidents, say for example mobile snatching, are more frequent. We also saw that criminals use motorcycles that help them run away easily. At times, it is difficult for police teams to chase them from our vehicles.
The unit chief also says that officers would only carry handguns, while in some locations, such as shopping malls, they will not be armed at all. Officers say they can now reach narrow alleys very quickly, where it's usually difficult to go. The rollerblading police are expected to be deployed officially next month.
The coronavirus and related restrictions have forced many businesses to either close or struggle. But some people have found ways to save their jobs and help others to survive the crisis. A top German chef is the one. Peter Frusamer now prepares dishes at a hospital canteen outside Berlin. Frusamer says before accepting the job, he was the head chef at his wife's restaurant. But it was closed due to the pandemic, and he chose to be a hospital cook rather than a jobless man. This German chef says he is happy to find some distraction while working in a hospital kitchen, besides making a contribution to patients' recovery.
I find it frustrating to be here and see the empty tables and the empty restaurant. When I'm at the hospital, I don't notice any of this. For me, the coronavirus crisis doesn't exist at the hospital. Sure, corona is always a topic, but there, I'm at work and I'm busy. But when I come here, I notice what a cut is going through society. That's why I'm happy to have my hospital and to find some distraction. Here in the restaurant, I could actually sit down and start crying.
The hospital staff also seem happy with Frusamer's presence. They say since the arrival of the new chef, they come to eat in the canteen regularly and discover new dishes not eaten before. Frusamer believes the reason health workers and patients love his dishes is that he gives his heart and soul to the food. That's a wrap up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jalod, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Today, we're going to be delving into the Islamic laws about the ladies according to Ayatollah Sistani. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzumah Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazvini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in fiqh and usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Javid, in the last episode, I asked you a rather long question, and you kindly provided an answer in part. Let me ask you this question in another way. And I asked you in the last program that if a woman recognizes herself as being in a state of hayd, yes. All right? Certainly there are, things that she can do and she cannot do. All right, yeah. And you mentioned to an experience of yours that you said in Ayatollah Sistani's office you have seen and read many emails from some countries that the women consider themselves, in fact, as not doing anything, basically, not even touching a towel. Or even me myself, I've seen a documentary. It was very funny that it happened in Africa, and some of the women there, they thought that they didn't even allow their kids to go to school, like the girls, yeah. Menstruating girls, not to go to school.
Yes.
So they considered this as like an unlawful act, according to the religion. Mm-hmm. So would you tell our audience and shed more light on the permissibility and impermissibility of some of the obligations she can do?
Let me reiterate by saying that a woman in the state of monthly discharge can touch everything, can cook, can attend religious ceremonies, can even go to a mosque, but provided that she enters from one gate and leaves, exits the mosque from another, and she does not stop there, she does not leave anything there or pick up from the mosque anything, of course. and she can do everything except certain things which are forbidden for her to do. One is prayer, of course. It's a matter of fact. There's no doubt about the fact that a woman who is discharging blood cannot offer prayer, whether the prayer is mustahab or wajib, whether it is obligatory or recommended. She cannot offer any kind of prayers.
No difference between the, or no dispute between the religious scholars.
Yeah, there's no difference. There's no discrepancy about this among the scholars. Then fasting is forbidden. Mm-hmm. And a woman who discharges monthly blood, her fast becomes white, and she cannot keep near of fasting. Okay,
I see.
If a woman is fasting, okay, it's now, let's say, 5 o'clock in the evening, and there is 1 hour left, and she discharges the period, and she gets her period all of a sudden, then her fast becomes white, and she cannot keep the niyyah, the intention of fasting. Okay, mm-hmm. That is forbidden. So see, she has to eat something, drink something, and of course her fast becomes white, and she cannot keep fasting. Then of course tawaf, I said in the previous episode, a woman in the state of monthly period cannot perform the circumambulation, mm-hmm. the tawaf of the house of God. She cannot enter the mosque, Masjid al-Haram, and she cannot perform and rotate the Kaaba unless she is ritually pure. And of course, reading the Quran is permissible, okay?
Yes.
And there's a difference of opinion among religious authorities. Some say, okay, you cannot read the entire chapter, even one letter of the four chapters in which there is an obligatory sajda. Mm-hmm. But Ayatollah Sistani says, no, you are not allowed to offer to recite that verse of the Quran which contains sajda.
Only okay? the verse.
And you're not allowed to read even one letter of that verse, okay?
Yes.
So there are four verses, inshallah. In the following episode, I will mention the number of the exact number of those verses.
I appreciate it.
Yes, and then we have also, there is another thing that men and women should observe. Sexual intercourse is strictly forbidden.
Yes.
Forbidden during menstrual discharge. Of course, a man and a woman can derive other pleasures from each other while the woman is menstruating. But vaginal sexual intercourse mm-hmm. is absolutely forbidden. And then entering a mosque is forbidden. Especially Masjid al-Haram and Masjid al-Nabi. But okay, if a woman wants to enter and her intention is to enter from one door and leave the mosque from another door, of course there's no problem. But halting, pausing in a mosque, or picking or leaving something in the mosque is not are not permissible. These are the things that...
But going through the mosque is possible?
Is permissible. Yes, uh-huh. Is permissible. Now, divorcing a woman who is experiencing her monthly discharge, is absolutely forbidden for the husband to divorce her.
Oh. Okay,
the divorce which takes place while the woman is in her menses is invalid. So therefore, the husband should make sure that the woman is that his wife is not discharging blood. It's not that the woman is not in her monthly period. Otherwise, if it transpires that the woman had been in her monthly period while the divorce was conducted, that divorce is invalid. Now, then touching the script of the Holy Quran, it is forbidden for a woman in the state of hayz or in the state of janaba or in the state of nifas, any of these impurities, to touch the script of the Holy Quran. And also touching the names of Allah, touching the names of the imams and the lady Fatima sallallahu alayha as an obligatory precaution. It is forbidden to touch any of these names. And also touching the attributes of Allah, because there are more than 100 attributes. And those attributes which are, of course, exclusively used for God, like for example Khaliq, okay, like Sustainer, these are the exclusive attributes or names of Allah.
Yes.
And these cannot be touched by a menstruating woman. Of course...
When you say they cannot touch, for example, divine attributes,
yes.
You mean that they can't touch it actually with their hands, like without gloves, for example, right?
Yeah.
Not without something like you can have like some plastic and then...
Yeah, that's permissible. There's no problem because there's a barrier, something which impedes the direct touch of the skin with the name of God or with something holy.
Okay.
Yes. These are some of the things which are forbidden for a woman, but as far as doing things are considered, of course, a woman is allowed to do everything except for these things. Okay. Mm-hmm. She can, as I said, and it's very important to insist and repeat it, that a woman in a state of mentally discharged is ritually impure. She's not essentially impure. For example, a dog is essentially impure according to Islamic Sharia. A pig is essentially impure. And it cannot, under any circumstances, a dog cannot be purified. A pig cannot be purified.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
Now, I want to conclude by saying that women who are in this state of monthly discharge are ritually impure. Ritually impure means ritual impurity is a kind of accidental impurity.
Yes.
Because the blood is discharged, the woman enters the state of menstruation. The menstruation continues for maximum 10 days. After the 10th day, the woman has to perform ghusl to gain that ritual purity, to attain and obtain the ritual purity. And of course, through performing the ghusl, the ablution, the woman regains that purity. But as far as attending, going to a Husseiniya, attending majalis, cooking nazar, okay, because some ladies in the Indian subcontinent believe that a menstruating woman cannot cook nazar. Okay, the food that is distributed among Muslim believers, among the Muslim community.
Mm-hmm.
So these are misconceptions and these are misunderstandings on the part of those women. And of course, I want them. Actually, it's very important for them to get acquainted with Islamic teachings, to read the Risala of the religious authorities, no matter which religious authority it is, but actually reading the Risala is by itself very important because it enriches a person's mind, it helps him or her actually improve her knowledge of the religious laws and religious rulings.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
لا إله إلا هو لا إله
10 minutes.
In mid-February, a man immensely influential in shaping Islamic thoughts and teachings in Indonesia died of the coronavirus. Social media pages were immediately flooded with condolences coming from across the socio-political spectrum, from activists to academics, to politicians and celebrities, to pay tribute to a religious scholar who had devoted his life to love, knowledge, and the promotion of moderation. Professor Jalaluddin Rahmat, better known by his nickname, Kang Jalal. Jalaluddin was born in Bandung in 1949 to an educated Muslim family. Despite his religious family background, Jalaluddin only received religious education until he graduated from elementary school. The library of Dutch residences, the remnant of the Dutch colony in the country, was one of the places the young Jalaluddin spent his time reading the works of great philosophers and thinkers such as Spinoza and Nietzsche. Jalaluddin attended the Paja Joran University and earned a degree in mass communications and began teaching there as a lecturer after graduation. He won a scholarship from Iowa State University, where he studied communications and psychology. Jalaluddin graduated with honors from the university in 1981 before returning to Indonesia. When he got home, Jalaluddin wrote a book on the psychology of communication, designed the curriculum for his faculty in the Paja Joran University, and gave lectures on various subjects such as Indonesia's political system, ethics, and Islam, which drew the attention of university students. In the meantime, Professor Rahmat went on an intellectual journey to the holy city of Qom, Iran, where he studied Irfan, or Islamic mysticism, as well as Islamic philosophy. Kang Jalal's interest in Irfan and Sufism began during a conference in Colombia back in 1984, where he met with a group of Iranian thinkers. The meeting and ensuing conversations eventually encouraged him to go to Iran, the birthplace of many great Sufis such as Imam Ghazali, Rumi, Attar Naishaburi, and Bayazid Bastami, classic figures known for their pluralistic tendencies, by which followers of different sects and religions could coexist peacefully. By the time he came back home from Iran, Jalal's way of thinking had already become even more influenced by Islamic Iranian mysticism, which promotes moderation and tolerance. At this point, many of his books on Sufism were written, such as Sufi Reformation, 1998, Reaching Divine Love, Sufi Enlightenment, 2000, The Road to Allah, 2007, The Way of Grace, Knocking on the Door of God, 2011, and so on. Jalal pursued his education in Australia, where he received his PhD in political science from the Australian National University. Upon arriving home, he began teaching various courses such as communications, philosophy of science, and mysticism at the country's most prestigious universities and institutes.
Jalaluddin Rahmat, name
Kang Jialo's mastery of several foreign languages besides English and Arabic, such as German, Dutch, French and Persian, made him able to access a wide range of thinkers in their own native languages, which in turn made his writings not only fresh and new, but also deep and sharp. Two of his books, Alternative Islam, 1986, and Actual Islam, 1991, which he wrote after his return from the United States, are widely read books by Muslim activists of all stripes. The mysticism developed by Kang Jialo, which drew upon the ideas of Sufi figures, was in fact an attempt to form a new civil society order where different sects and religions could peacefully interact with each other under the umbrella of religious pluralism. In this phase, Jalal's Sufistic works, such as Religious Psychology, 2003, and Islam and Pluralism, 2006, are not only divine, but also humanist-themed books. In the year 2000, Jalal ad-Din established the Indonesian Ahlul Bayt Association, IJABI, a major Shia Muslim organization with around 2.5 million members. The association has been a platform for fostering friendship and cooperation among leaders of different religions in Indonesia. Apart from his academic endeavor, Kang Jialo fought for decades for the marginalized groups, those at the bottom of the ladder. In fact, supporting the underdog was the driving force for Kang Jialo behind establishing a number of schools, which are now among the well-known educational centers across Indonesia. Around 1994, Kang Jialo initiated a program called the Spiritual Camp for his students. The students, most of which were from the upper middle class, were taken to remote areas for a week or so to develop sympathy for poor families. One of the positive impacts of the program was that these students began teaching underprivileged children free of charge. In fact, Professor Rahmat sought education equality, which he considered to be the key to having a better society. He also helped students unable to pay for school fees, but had genuine interest and enthusiasm for learning. By 1997, Kang Jialo had managed to convince his well-off friends to cover the costs of these students so they could receive an equal quality of education. Not satisfied with that, in the same year, Kang Jialo founded Mutaharian Asajodia Junior High Schools in Kikalenga, Bandung, for students and families who could not afford high-quality education. Once he said, "My dream is to see schools like Mutahari School in all corners of the country so that poor children are not cut off from education." He helped many students who are going to continue their education in the Middle East and Europe.
Republik Indonesia, tahun
1900. Jialo ad-Din was also a member of the Indonesian Democratic Party of Struggle, the PDIP, the only party he believed defended minorities. He served as the member of the People's Representative Council of Indonesia from 2014 to 2019. Jialo ad-Din was seated in Commission 8 of the Council, which handles religion, social affairs and the empowerment of women, things he cared passionately about during his life. Professor Jialo ad-Din Rahmat is the epitome of a real religious man who believed worshipping God to be in parallel with serving his creatures. In his book, The Road to Allah, Kang Jialo wrote, "There are many ways to approach God, as many as the breath of the seekers of God. But the closest path to Allah is to make others around you happy. You serve them."
IRIB English Radio.